The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.
This is Mike Consul. Thank you for listening. Welcome to the program. Our guest today is Gianluca Minella. He's head of infrastructure research at DWS Group. And the organization recently produced a white paper that's available on the website that deals with a lot of infrastructure considerations, one of which is rail. We're going to talk about that today. There's about 700 railroads that operate common carrier and freight services in the United States. There's about 160,000 miles of railroad track in the U.S. And that's just in the U.S. We're not even that favorable towards a railroad anymore. I mean, it was part of the great expansion of the United States, part of our great industrial and transportation revolution, but Europeans seem to, and Asian countries seem to find railroads to be passenger rail to be quite romantic. And here in the United States, we fight about whether Amtrak should be defunded or not. But the fact of the matter is, railroads have been rolling for a long time. They've performed very well during the, we're going to talk a little bit about how they did during the pandemic. And also, of course, how do investors get to play in that arena, given that titans such as Warren Buffett has long had a stake in railroads, owned railroad operators to good effect. So Gianluca Minella, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Mike. Ciao.
Ciao to you. And let's talk about rail as a catalyst and maybe a beneficiary of the decarbonization trend in the United States. Let's start there because there's just so much effort right now to try to, with climate change and the move away from individual vehicles, the move to electrification, getting people to use more mass transit. What kind of role does rail play in that arena?
Sure. I would say that, first of all, rail is a very, very old traditional infrastructure sector, and one that has been, for over a century now, grown slowly, albeit steadily, alongside demographics and alongside really the expansion of global trade. Lately, however, rail seems to be again at the center of the infrastructure sector in general because of its ability to be used to decarbonize transport and especially decarbonize freight transport. Now, we know that in the United States, a lot of the trucks are used operating diesel trains, diesel locomotives. This is slightly different in Europe, where most of the railroads are electrified. But we also know that because of government policies, decarbonization of locomotives will play a key role over the next years, either through the use of alternative fuels, such as, for example, biofuels, or via the adoption, for example, of dual fuel locomotives that are able to use electricity when on an electrified track and then switch to, for example, alternative fuels, such as could be hydrogen in the future. As such, we see a very strong interest from infrastructure investors in supporting this strong need for capital. And we see policy as well as a key contributor. Especially in Europe, we see that the European Union policy is really aiming at shifting big part of the road transport for freight on rail in an attempt to reduce carbon emissions. Just to give you an idea, road freight tends to emit 5 times the carbon that rail freight emits. And this would really give you a good indication of why rail can be so central in this decarbonization trend that will be with us over the next 2 decades.
Mm. Now, is the amount of rail in the United States... Well, I have too many questions I want to ask at once. Let me ask you about electrification. The electrification is, what, only a small percentage of the rail in the United States, is that right? And is that really in the cities where you've got subway systems and maybe Boston, New York to New York corridor and all that sort of thing? What percentage is electrified? I don't even know if you have that figure at your fingertips, Gianluca.
Well, in the United States, we are talking about a very small percentage for longer trucks that connect different cities and different states. As you correctly said, a big part of the urban rail systems are electrified, because effectively electrification is a sort of like goes alongside density. Yeah. An area, the denser an area it is, the more sort of like interested we'll be in electrifying it, because there will be this opportunity to make the money back effectively. As such, even in certain other global regions, such as, for example, Europe, today, if you take, for example, the UK, some parts of the UK rail networks, despite the stronger density of population in the UK, are not electrified. But here we see, as I was explaining before, that as the market gradually provides alternatives to electric locomotives, such as, for example, with hydrogen, or again with fuels that are sort of like significantly more sustainable from an emission perspective, such as biofuels, we will suddenly see that despite the lack of sort of like economic interest in electrifying certain routes, there will still be a way to use those routes and these rail tracks to provide sustainable transport.
So is the opportunity then is global, is that right? The opportunity for investors is global, and if that's the case, what continents are are all continents opportunities, or are there only certain ones?
So when we looked at the market, we stand at seeing that effectively we are talking about, when we talk about rolling stock, so the vehicles that operate on trucks, a market that today is at about $50 billion, but may well basically double in size by the mid-2030s. Of course, the bulk of the growth may be concentrated in emerging economies that are growing rapidly, such as the Asian economies. However, we see that the policy that I was describing before is really acting as a catalyst also in developed markets. And particularly, we see this as a strong trend in Europe, where policy is aligned also with a very detailed regulation and liberalization process of the rail sector, which has taken place over a number of decades and has enabled effectively the market to gradually become bigger and more interesting for private infrastructure investors.
Now, is the what is the investment opportunity just in terms of how is the investment, how does an institutional investor invest? What are the opportunities? What are the channels? Are there funds that are dedicated to rail? Or are these diversified infrastructure funds? Is there opportunity for high net worth and ultra high net worth individuals? Or is the cost involved in participating really reserved strictly for institutional investors?
So the rail system is fairly complicated, and we explain in the paper exactly how to look at it. But effectively, while tracks traditionally are either directly or indirectly controlled by governments, or in the case of the United States, of course, by large freight operators, more and more we see infrastructure investors deciding to use these trends of growing demographics, decarbonization, liberalization, and technological evolution by effectively investing in the rolling stock that operates on the on these rail tracks. And, you know, normally we think that infrastructure should be bolted on the ground, but this is a typical example of assets that, despite not being bolted on the ground, can enjoy very stable and predictable demand and cash flows. Historically, we have seen diversified core infrastructure strategies, so focusing mainly on yield and supported by institutional investors, focusing on regulated rolling stock. So normally providing rolling stock, especially for passenger rail in geographies such as the UK, where there are very long-term contracts supporting the use of that rolling stock with revenues that are even indexed at inflation. However, as the market opportunity shifts gradually beyond passenger rail and particularly into freight, into the decarbonization of freight and the stronger need to sort of like have rail capacity that is able to transport our freight, we see that infrastructure investors now are concentrating on acquiring a rolling stock platform that effectively operate as platforms that procure rolling stock and then lease it to freight operators that transport the goods. While in this case, contracts are sometimes not that long term, however, these strategies enjoy a very diversified revenue structure with a number of users and, of course, the ability to manage fleets actively to sort of like optimize them and optimize the return profile. This is a sector historically where institutional investors have focused. However, we see that more and more as the private infrastructure space opens up also to high net worth and even retail clients. We expect also this type of investors that look for a predictable return stream to focus on similar strategies as part of broader strategies that invest in infrastructure.
Now, your report, which your white paper, which again is available on the DWS website, mentions that railway or rolling stock, as you call it, provides essential service and has high barriers to entry. Talk about that a little bit. The barriers, obviously, it does provide an essential service. We get that. But what are the barriers to entry? How high are they, and how would you characterize them?
Sure. In terms of rail, when we look at rail and rolling stock, especially, I would say for both passenger and freight rail, we really look at an essential service, which is really essential for the functioning of the economy and is really at the core today at the European policymaker focus to support that modal shift I was discussing about from road to rail. When we look at the high barriers to entry of the sector, there are a number of them. First of all, there are very large upfront costs and economies of scale that act as a barrier to entry. What is very interesting here is that procuring rolling stock fleets can be extremely expensive, and this is something typically that does act as a barrier to entry. And we also have a very limited number of manufacturers globally with very long construction times and limits in terms of supply of new rolling stock. So the ability of an asset manager to acquire a rolling stock platform and use that knowledge and experience to procure these rolling stock can be very important. Also, we shouldn't forget that things like being able to access the rail network and the deposits on the rail networks where the train are stored, where the train are maintained, acts also as a very, very important barrier to entry to the operators and effectively does limit competition. And finally, it is a complex sector. It is complex to operate. So there are only a handful, at least in Europe, of large sort of like rolling stock platform that have the knowledge and the skills to manage such a complex sector.
Interesting. So have you paid any attention to some of these private rail systems that they're trying to build in the United States? For example, in Texas, my understanding is they're trying to build a high-speed rail network between the major cities in Texas, which would seem to me to be a, you know, could be quite an economic boom to connect those cities in that way and allow commuting between cities like San Antonio and Dallas and Austin and Houston and so on. Then in Florida, there's some private investors who are trying to connect. Again, like Texas, Florida has a lot of cities to connect right within the state there. They've got a lot of pretty big cities over there. So there's people who are saying that the government's not going to fund this, that the government doesn't really have the money to do this. It's going to take private investors. Are you familiar with those systems? And what do you think are the prospects for their success?
So when it comes to passenger rail, clearly building an entire new rail system or new rail tracks is something that can be extremely expensive and often sees support from governments to make sure that, you know, that these systems become economical. In fact, in most of the other global regions, such as, for example, Europe, if you take it as an example, you see that ultimately, the ownership of the tracks does remain in the hands of the public sector, either directly or indirectly through stakes in the large national incumbent operators, because there is an element of lack of profitability in operating these tracks. And that's why investors tend to focus much more on the provision of the rail services. That said, in that sense, passenger rail beyond freight can be extremely interesting because we have, you mentioned the high-speed rail, but not only high-speed rail is a trend where we see a growing demand for rolling stock. We also see this, for example, for multiple unit trains or even for metro and light rail that we saw at the beginning. So a strong push, typically a push that for passenger rail goes alongside really demographic trend and demographic growth. For freight, the situation seems more complex because in the freight sector, we have a number of very different types of rolling stock from open wagons to hoppers to flat wagons, covered wagons, tank wagons. Clearly, some of these segments will suffer over the coming years as, for example, coal and lignite, or even to some extent oil and natural gas phase out from, let's say, global trade. So, open wagons and tank wagons may well undergo some negative growth. However, some other segments alongside passenger rail may grow quite rapidly and quite substantially, such as, for example, intermodal wagons or specialized wagons, or even to some extent flat wagons that operate and transport general machinery, for example. So I think a very, very interesting trend to observe for freight beyond really passenger rail. But again, these greenfield new projects, we see it also in Asia, tend to sometimes end up being uneconomical if you don't see any state grants or state support in them.
Now, I said at the top, I was talking about how rail performed during COVID-19. How did it perform during COVID? And how is it performing right now in terms of this whole backup we've got? I'm thinking specifically in the United States of the supply chain backup. You see it with shipping. Are we having the same problem with rail? How did it perform during COVID-19? How is it performing right now?
So a very, very good question. I would say that we have seen two very different stories during COVID-19. On one side, passenger rail has been, in terms of demand, hit very hardly by the stay-at-home measures, which effectively have brought demand, in many cases, down to zero for many months, especially around commuter rail areas. While demand has gone down, in many cases, where we saw the involvement of private infrastructure investors around procuring, for example, and operating those franchises and those lines, such as, for example, around London in the UK, we've seen the government stepping in and providing extraordinary support during lockdown periods, ensuring a cash flow that would enable investors to pay back debt and even provide them with a small fee for the management of the fleet as the fleet was at a standstill. This gives you a sense of how strategic passenger rail can be. On freight, a very different picture, because freight has been extremely resilient during COVID, and actually rail freight has been benefiting because of one factor. In many cases, this was a shortage of truck drivers, and so all those goods have been rather moved by freight where possible in terms of rail rather than road. At the moment, as you correctly mentioned, this strong supply-demand imbalance that we see in the market, to some extent with economic demand having rebounded and supply leading, lagging behind a little bit, has brought to freight rates increasing substantially, also when it comes to rail. But the system, I think, globally has proven to be extremely resilient, both if we look at Europe and if we look at the United States. As to some extent this supply-demand imbalance adjusts over the coming quarters, we expect a normalization of freight rates and sort of like the system to revert back to some sort of normality. However, structurally, we see that capacity, like I was discussing about, which will be fueled by the shift from road to rail on a more sort of like a systemic basis driven by decarbonization policies.
Now, your report mentions that post-COVID, the post-COVID market environment might be a good opportunity, a good entry point for acquiring transportation assets. Why now? Why is now a particularly good day, or post-COVID, a particularly good time to get involved in rail?
So, interestingly enough, I think private infrastructure valuations have remained relatively resilient during COVID, and post-COVID, over the last, I would say, 12 months, as the pandemic to some extent has, the situation of the pandemic improved a little bit, while in other markets we have seen a sharp bounce back of valuations to some extent reaching new historical records. In infrastructure, especially around transportation, we have, of course, seen a way more prudent approach in terms of valuations because of some of the uncertainty related to the demand I was describing before. So overall, from a tactical perspective, it seems a very, very good moment to enter the transportation market because those valuations appear very attractive. And this is particularly true for rail and rolling stock in particular, because when you do look actually at the valuations historically, and we do it in the report, you see that this is a market that is effectively underpinned by alpha rather than beta. In other words, there is a strong opportunity here to generate value in the market by finding opportunities that are mispriced compared to the overall market, and finding opportunities that enable infrastructure investors to maybe use M&A activity to grow platform and support the value of the sector. There is also a very important trend. As this sector gradually becomes bigger and more infrastructure investors become gradually more familiar with it, we expect to some extent a compression in cost of equity expectations from investors, which should, in other words, really support valuations over the long term and an increase in valuation. So both I would say, cyclical dynamic as well as a structural dynamic for the rolling stock market that provide that can prove really attractive at the moment. We expect the cyclical one to close over the course of 2022 as gradually economies return to normality. We start seeing that transportation assets are really going back to the valuations that we saw to some extent pre-COVID, especially for sectors such as rail that really have strong cash flow visibility ahead of them.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So to our listeners, I went to the DWS.com website. If you put in the search term rolling stock, the report comes up. Now, there's probably other search terms you can put in there that will bring the report up, but easy way to do it right from the homepage. Gianluca, just as a final question, what have I overlooked here? What else should investors listening in know about rail that is important to their consideration of rail, or maybe just of interest to them? What else would you add?
I would add that it is a niche sector to some extent, particularly when it comes to infrastructure investors, especially when it comes to some extent, geographies that are not core Europe or North America, but it is a sector that is expected to grow. As a result, what we have really focused on in the report is demystifying the sector, understanding how the rail system works, what role rolling stock or rail infrastructure or even signaling and control play in the overall system, how policy and regulation affect the system, and really how infrastructure investors should look at the fundamental characteristics of a complex sector to be able to extract value from it. And there are plenty of opportunities to do that. I'll hope that readers will enjoy the report, because I think beyond highlighting the investment opportunity, there is a lot of work in explaining how the system works and even how it is expected to change. Let's think, for example, about intermodal transport and increased focus about having rail undertakings that to some extent in multimodal transport operations enable sort of like a shift from road to rail, maybe not for the entire journey of freight, but for a big part of the journey, reducing carbon emissions. So very technical, but also very detailed. But again, it is that sort of detail and that sort of the experience and knowledge that is needed to be able to understand the sector and to make the most out of it in terms of investments.
You know, I do have one other question that has to do with just the technology of rail transportation. Now, we're moving towards, I mean, if we could snap our fingers and electrify all of the tracks, we would do that so that we don't have to be belching diesel fumes. But what else is happening in rail in terms of technology? What's the next level? I mean, I've been on the maglev train, magnetic levitation train in Beijing, and that's amazing. It was like 300 miles an hour and built by the Germans for the Chinese back at the time. That's a, you know, different piece of technology that I'm sure we wouldn't roll out nationally. But what are the next breakthroughs in rail in terms of technological innovation?
Sure. I think, you know, we have some medium-term breakthrough and then some very long-term breakthrough. Sometimes these very long-term breakthroughs may appear futuristic. Let's think about things like Hyperloop, for example. But without even looking so far away, today it is very interesting to see that we have two key trends. On one side, digitalization is affecting rail systems way more than one would think. Let's think about the signaling, for example, or sensors that are used on trains to reduce maintenance, improve safety, but importantly, improve the capacity of networks way beyond what we see today. So use networks to transport way more goods than it would have been, than they would have been or passengers before. The second one is, again, along the sides of what we were saying before. While electrification of networks may always not be possible, we see technological evolution in trains that are, is not only making them more efficient, but also enables them to use, for example, alternative fuels to be powered. And again, hydrogen trains are not yet a full commercial reality, but they do exist, and we expect them to become a commercial reality over the next years, as, for example, hydrogen becomes one of the key fuels used to decarbonize our economies. And again, today we also see more stringent regulation, for example, around the blending of the diesel used to power rail with, for example, biofuels to reduce emissions. So there is a lot of innovation going on in this sense. And to some extent, this innovation should bring us to have systems that are capable of transporting more and doing it in a more sustainable way, not only within regions, but as you mentioned, there are some large projects, for example, that look at using rail to transport goods across different global regions. However, let's say these are perhaps less interesting for investors today because we're talking about very large projects that involve governments rather than sort of like direct infrastructure investors.
Mm-hmm. The world is changing. Our guest has been Gianluca Minella. He's head of infrastructure research at DWS Group. And we've been talking rail. Gianluca, thank you for your time. And hopefully the United States and the world at large will be on a roll these coming years.
Thank you, Mike.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.